Welcome to another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. My name is H.F. Mason. I'm a general surgeon and chief quality officer for the Baptist System.
Hey, everyone. I'm Brad Parsons, vice president of market operations at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
And I'm Bill Cloud, assistant chief medical officer for Baptist Healthcare.
Well, guys, we are so excited today. Our guest is Michael Chad Heppner. Michael is I don't want to say public speaking, but he is in the business of helping people communicate. His business and website is called Genuine Know-How, and today we're going to discuss his new book, which should be very interesting. It's called Don't Say and we've already had a lot of discussion about this before we went live. But Michael, welcome to Connecting the Dots, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, you teed it up exactly right. Most of my time is spent helping people talk better when it matters. So, of course, public speaking or presenting is one of those categories, but a lot of the time I'm helping people just get more comfortable speaking in a board meeting or having a kind of challenging conversation. I've been doing that for almost 20 years. I started the company you mentioned. I started that in 2010, more or less. GK Training is the website if people want to find it, gktraining.com. Anyway, I started that company, and most of my time is spent helping people who are pretty senior now at this point in their career. So folks like presidential candidates even, and CEOs and folks like that. But over the last couple of years, I wanted to try to make some of that training accessible to people who were not running for president. So I wrote a book called Don't Say and I'm more than happy to tell you why I chose that title.
Well, tell us a little bit how you got into this business. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, you got it. Sure. So I come from this into this field from a performing background. I was a professional actor for almost a decade. I got my MFA at NYU, and I worked in Broadway and film and TV for a number of years. But then what I really discovered is that as fascinating as being a creative artist was, I became even more fascinated with how people learn to portray different characters. And even more than that, and this I think is incredibly relevant to all of you and the study of medicine and how the human body works, I became even more interested in how people can learn tremendously powerful new habits very quickly just by using their bodies in different ways. And as I became a student of that, I began to develop a whole bunch of kinesthetic exercises to help people do really important stuff like tolerate silence and speak with enthusiasm and use eye contact and free their gestures, these sorts of things. And so I built a whole company doing that. And now I do that with leaders around the world.
I really love that. And I appreciate that, Michael. Thanks for joining us today. We talk a lot about how people learn on this podcast, Connecting the Dots. And it's really what I catch myself thinking about more today, probably than anything else. We're a big organization. We get to work with lots of talented people, but we see that people get into kind of ruts for how they do their work. So I'm really curious, even before we get to the topic of today in your book, some of your experience of what you've learned about how people learn and how do you really tap into that as leaders that oversee leaders that are really tasked with doing complex work every day?
Yeah. One of the reasons I was so excited to have this conversation is that in studying what you all have been putting out there, this idea of continual improvement is fascinating to me. And I want to mention two things from your question. So the first is about how people improve and how do they get stuck in these ruts. And as communicators, they get stuck in ruts terribly. And it's often because they get well-meaning but terrible advice. And it usually has three problems. One, it's thought suppression. Two, it's general. And then three, it's a mental reminder for what is a physical activity. So here's the example. All you fast talkers out there, you know you talk too fast. You've heard this before. What do you hear when people try to help you? First, you hear, don't talk too fast. Okay, well, as soon as I say don't, you already see the pink elephant in your consciousness coming, right? Don't is essentially thought suppression. And a colleague of mine at Columbia, not a medical doctor, but a sociologist, he studies thought suppression, and humans are terrible at thought suppression. We can't do it. So it's doomed to fail right away. Then the second piece of advice we get is totally general. Just slow down. Okay, when? Between words? In the midst of words? After paragraphs? How would one ever do this very general suggestion? And then the third thing is a mental reminder. Remember to breathe. Remember to pause. But it's a mental reminder for what is a physical activity. Now, you all know, you know, the kinesthetics of the human body well enough that if someone is in a pattern of breathing in a certain tempo or moving their bodies in a certain way, giving them one more thing to multitask in their brains, remember to, is doomed to fail. So we get a lot of terrible advice. It's well-meaning. It's not meant to sabotage us, but it's bad advice, and it tends to get us stuck in ruts. So anyway, that's one of the first thoughts I had about your ideas about continual improvement and why a lot of the coaching ends up doing the exact opposite of that.
Michael, this brings to mind my experiences with golf lessons, okay? So there's a tendency to, for those who are instructing students of the game in golf swing, to break it down into a million parts and you can't focus on anything. So where do you start with learning how to communicate better?
Yeah. Thank you for making the golf analogy. You're 100% right. And that was the second thing I wanted to get to about this idea of continual improvement. What I'm after almost every day with every client is helping them unlock a virtuous cycle in which one small intervention, so, you know, one small change in your golf swing all of a sudden unlocks a whole bunch of knock-on effects that makes everything better. So, you can think about this as a positive feedback loop, essentially. And most of the time, I'm trying to help them unlock that cycle from delivery to content. And delivery, that means how you say stuff, enunciation, vocal variety, eye contact, gestures, those sorts of things, everything besides the words. And the amazing thing is that when people often find this one single leverage point on the delivery side, what happens is incredible. They sound better because the delivery gets better, but even more profound is they actually start to think of smarter stuff to say. So they better stuff.
The rewards are exponential, or the benefits, and that aligns so much with the way we approach improvement is, you know, our improvement system and management systems based on the Toyota production system. And it's, you know, you're here and you want to get here. What is the one action that you can take? And I watched a couple of your talks where you talk about what is one action that you could take today to help you become a better communicator. But another thing I want to discuss is that, and this really intrigued me, was on your website, right at the top, it says communication is physical. And we think about all these other, you know, audible, visual, but unpack that for us, if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, I have to say this is pretty funny and ironic that I'm talking to a bunch of folks with profound medical backgrounds about the physical aspect of speaking. But yeah, you can school me probably. Once I tee up the topic, you'll probably help me on this one. We have this fallacy that we hang on to when it comes to speaking, where we really think, if I could just think of what to say, if I can just think of the smart thoughts, then I'm going to say smart stuff and everyone's going to, you know, fall in line as I want them to, hire me, be persuaded, like me, whatever the outcome is. And that completely misses the fact that speaking is a physical activity. We're essentially a woodwind instrument. We take air, and then we transform the air into sound, and then we shape and alter that sound into words that can be understood. And that's a physical pathway. Your diaphragm drops down so your lungs can fill with air. And this is a part where I'm going to lecture a bunch of doctors on how the human body works. But sure, your lungs inflate with air, and then that air flows over your vocal cords and creates that little vibration that then gets amplified throughout the entire body. And even if you say the word enunciation, and just for a moment check in with how dynamically the mouth and the tongue and the jaw move in coordination to make that word, it's astonishing, actually. This is a physical thing, and we completely forget that. And if you forget that aspect, you're going to be doomed to stay stuck in that loop of, like, next time I got to remember to say this thing. Oh, next time someone says that to me, I'm going to come back with this thing. Oh, next meeting, when I get that opportunity, I'm going to say, and you get stuck in this sort of revisionist history of constantly living in the past. And it's incredibly difficult to unlock any improvement when you're mired in that kind of a mindset.
I really like the concept of unlocking the virtuous cycle and then coupling it with this physical activity. So is it safe to say that the physical activity may be one of the first things that you need to be mindful of as you go into speaking?
Yeah, I'll take it even one further. If you're listening to this and you know you have some pattern, or maybe you even think of it as a liability or a flaw, trust me, that actually is addressable faster than you think. And the way to address it is physical. So I'll give you a couple of very concrete examples. If you know that you speak too quickly, don't tell yourself to slow down. Put an impediment in between your teeth. You could use a piece of wrapped candy. You could bite on the end of your pinky finger. Bite on the end of a pencil. Use a toothbrush. And then, like a sprinter running with a parachute on to increase the drag behind them to make their muscles stronger, fight past that impediment to make your speech totally clear even with the impediment. What will happen? You will speak much slower. If you have a difficult time tolerating silence when you ask important questions and you just keep talking because you're nervous in that situation, on Zoom calls, ask a question, a single question, and at the end of the question, under the kind of digital cloak of invisibility where the camera's frame ends, draw an imaginary question mark with your finger in silence. If you say too many ums to the title of the book, don't tell yourself to don't say it won't work. Instead, walk your fingers across a desk or table, deliberately choosing each word that comes out of your mouth and using the activity of stepping your fingers forward. And I'm doing it now. You can probably hear it in my voice. Stepping your fingers forward to force yourself to choose each word. Now, those are just three quick kinesthetic exercises that I use to help people experience a radically different muscle memory and therefore change habits pretty quickly. So yes to your question, yes, change it physical, and yes, it can be faster than you think.
Our chief improvement officer, who shall remain nameless, but you met him earlier, he has an action where he puts his finger over his lips because when he tends to speak too much. So I guess that kind of aligns with what you're saying.
Yeah. And, you know, go back to the golf metaphor for a second. If you were working with a golf coach and you knew that you had I'm a terrible golfer, by the way, so I could give you a bunch of the things that aren't right. But let's say you have some habit, like you shank all your shots or you dip your hip too much or collapse your elbow, whatever it is, think of something. You would never accept a golf pro on Wednesday saying a bunch of general advice and a bunch of things to remember and then expecting your golf game to be different on Sunday. They would do something very much like you just mentioned, Dr. Mason, which is they would change some fundamental aspect of your form, just like you're talking about chief improvement officer putting their finger over their mouth to remind themselves to stop talking. The golf pro would do the same thing. Shift how your one grip was being held, make you put your feet together to isolate your upper body, something like that. And we forget that communication is essentially a sport and we should treat its improvement the same way.
So, Michael, how do you get, you start with yourself first, but if you're particularly challenged by a person that you're really part of the team and you're trying to find a way to work better, and it's not necessarily the speed of the communication, but the type of communication, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, is a bunch of sentences strung together that are like squirrel, 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 and they're all in different directions, and you're having a tough time following their train of thought. What is the best way to communicate to that person, hey, should we just hand them Michael's book? How do we start there?
Yeah, well, actually, you should. And that's not to it's not to brag about my book.
Buy the book, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, people buy the book. But the funny thing is you'll hear me say something that no author ever says. I don't actually care if you read this book. I don't. I do care if you read one chapter of this book, because I hope that people use it like a cookbook. I mean, no one reads a cookbook from beginning to end. You go to the recipe that you really want to learn how to make, and you practice it, and you all of a sudden you have a new recipe in your cooking arsenal. And the same thing is true here. So the first skill building chapter, chapter 6, teaches the exact exercise you're asking about. And all it features is a page you rip out, you tear it into 6 strips, and you practice speaking. But here's the crucial thing. You can only share one idea at a time, not 25, one. And at the end of each idea, you have to put a strip of paper down. Then you pick up the next strip of paper. You say your next idea. At the end of it, in silence, you have to place the piece of paper down. And you have to tolerate silence until you pick up the third piece, and so on and so forth. Now, you might be thinking, like, okay, well, yeah, you're just moving paper. How does that help this squirrel problem you just described? I would posit to say something truly controversial, which is it's the fastest and maybe even only way to escape the pattern that they're currently in. Because their pattern is very likely, I open my mouth, I start talking, good stuff's going to come out, hopefully it doesn't. Later on, they're like, oh God, I just got to be more logical or more structured. I better work harder. But they're working harder at the wrong stuff. And doing this little exercise, what it does is it makes a tiny physical intervention. And in that moment of placing the paper down, they get to think. And they actually think about, should I keep talking? Was that the best sentence? What is the next thing that I should share? And they begin to be a much more judicious communicator and actually curate the words that are coming out of their mouth as opposed to just opening their mouth and letting words tumble out.
Michael, I don't think anyone would argue that there are some people who are naturally born. They have more God-given talent for communicating, for public speaking. But what do you tell the naysayers who say, I just can't, you know, that's just not in my wheelhouse. I can't do it. I'll never be able to get up in front of a crowd. I'll never be able to lead a meeting. I get too nervous or I stutter or whatnot.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would ask them is, have you ever gotten better at a sport or a musical instrument or a physical discipline like dance or a martial art? And I would just keep going until I found some physical skill that they have learned. And then I would make the analogy, and it's not even an analogy, it's just true, that speaking is a whole coordinated act of physical movements that can be practiced and improved with kinesthetic learning. And I would help them have some kind of a breakthrough moment in 60 minutes so that they could be a believer too. And then from that one little point of improvement, then you can build a whole empire.
Sure. I want to get a little philosophical now. I mean, yeah. Tell me what you think about our younger generation. And for our listeners, I'm holding up a cell phone.
Oh boy.
Where this has become the number one way that not only our young people, but we communicate. And is it a threat to our communication skills? And are we going to become just more dumbed down as the years go on?
Yeah, well, buckle up, gentlemen, because those folks who are hoping to hear a both sides argument on this one, you're not about to get that from me. I would not only validate what you're suggesting, or at least what I think you're suggesting with that kind of leading question, I would double down, triple down, quadruple down if I could. I think cell phones, there are certainly some things they have unlocked in our lives, but I think a screen-based life is truly detrimental in so many ways. And you all know this much more than I do. I'm sure there's lots of physiological things about being sedentary, about the posture and position of, you know, text, neck, and things like that. I'm sure there's a ton of stuff that you could educate the listeners about. But to the point of communication, yes, I think it is a dire threat, because we are communal animals. One of humanity's superpowers is our ability to shape sound into words, to try to motivate a group to team up to do something. I mean, think of us in a tribe trying to protect ourselves from, you know, some sort of predator group or something. Now we talk into screens a whole bunch of time. And a lot of the kids that parents hire me to coach, believe it or not, they've missed a huge step in just how reciprocal communication works, how physical it is. And I think screens are a real problem. I'm very much in like the Jonathan Haidt anxious generation school of thought on this one. I think we've taken a pretty dramatic wrong turn, and I think we have to course correct forcefully to try to get control of these devices.
Michael, let me ask you a question about people who maybe have dyslexia and other really neuromotor problems, neuromuscular problems. Have you been engaged with people that actually have true impediments, not just psychological, but physical impediments, and had success with this as well?
There's some nuance here. The answer is yes, I have. And yes, I've helped some people for sure. But the very first thing that I say is, look, I will tell you what I think I do exceptionally well. And I will also tell you what I have no business coaching people on whatsoever. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a speech pathologist. And if there's some sort of truly mechanical thing going on in terms of someone's speech, or they're neurologically divergent in some sort of way that establishes a different pattern for what good looks like for that person, I'm the first one to say, I'm going to show you some things, but these are just tools that one can explore. And I am by no means the world's expert on something like this. All that said, here's the amazing thing. Very often, if you help people, and under this category of people, I'm calling, let's say, people who are neurologically divergent or perhaps have some of the challenges you're talking about in terms of the functioning of speech. If you help them feel less self-conscious, be more focused on the person they're speaking to and the ideas they're trying to share, and to release physical tension from their body, very often, even though the mechanical thing that is, you know, a difficulty for them does not change, the rest of their communication instrument frees up in a way that their strengths all of a sudden can lift up quite a lot. And so I never lean into it saying, like, this is my specialty, let me help you how to overcome that stutter. But rather, if you can help them holistically as a communicator, very often it carries a lot of water and helps them a bunch. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, Michael, I want to go back to the title of your book. And we already had a little levity with this. I'm sure that, and for our listeners out there, I'm winning an count for today already. And so I'm curious, is and again, really fascinated by this discussion, and really appreciate your work and how you've approached it. Can you share with us a little bit of levity for some of the things that are created with a book that's titled Don't Say with a bunch of people that are beginning to have a conversation with each other?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I chose the title very intentionally because I want people to see it instantly, be familiar with that idea, and pick up the book. And, you know, to the extent that it has worked, it's a best-selling book. So, you know, good for the title. But really, of course, as soon as you open the cover, you find out the preface that it's a bit of a trick. It's to get you to pick it up and start reading and then realize, oh my gosh, all this don't stuff I've been hearing and telling myself my whole life doesn't work. And so then the book hopefully helps you figure out how to be a more precise and effective communicator. But to your point, I never in my life thought that I would intimidate people as a person. I think I'm, you know, as your listeners can probably tell, I'm a cruel and mean and judgmental person who never cuts anyone slack. I'm joking, of course. Hopefully you can hear the dripping sarcasm off my speech there.
Dripping.
But I do intimidate people, which is hilarious in large part because of the title of the book. They start talking to me and they think, oh my God. Is he watching every single that? And now I'm thinking about and the fun part of that, it's a little bit irreverent, but the fun part is that it's kind of proving the point of the title, which is as soon as you start thinking about the and more damningly, as soon as you start just thinking about yourself as a communicator, that's when it all breaks down. So, you know, in the chapter on linguistic precision, I joke with people and I say, I'm not the police. And in fact, I don't even have interest in eradicating every What I am interested in, and you all will be fascinated about this just because of how you look at symptomology and use diagnostics all the time, I am interested in as a diagnostic. And what I mean by that is, let's say you're talking to a friend, helping them try to overcome a crisis or figure out a a solution to something, and you say every 15 seconds, okay, who cares? But if you go into that crucial press conference or interview and all of a sudden you say an every 3 seconds, what that tells you is you have shifted in some way that is not helping you. Either you become much more habitual in your communication, or you've become much more self-conscious. And those ums actually are worth paying attention to. So I'm sorry if I made you self-conscious. I apologize profusely.
Michael, when we talk about leadership, one of the skills that we talk about is how important listening is. And can you touch on that about how proper listening can help you be a better physical communicator? Could you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah.
Because sometimes we find ourselves, you know, not listening, just trying to think about, okay, what do I want to say next without even hearing what the other person's saying?
Yeah. Yeah. What I'm going to do is I'm going to fast forward to exercises you can do to be a better listener.
Sure.
And the reason I'm going to fast forward is I am by far not the wisest voice, this call included, who has ever said that listening is important, but let's get it much bigger, right? Like every great spiritual and religious tradition in the world and mindfulness tradition talks about the importance of listening, or sure, maybe talks is the wrong way to put it, right? Listens about listening. The whole adage of, you know, you have two ears and one mouth so that you listen twice as much as you speak. So let's say we grant that listening is crucial, essential. How can you do it better? And the way I often help people do that is that there are these habits they have that get in the way of their listening. One is one I've mentioned already, which is people have a very difficult time asking a single question and then, to use a crude term, shutting up and just letting the person speak. So often I will have people do that finger walking exercise I suggested, in which you walk your fingers across the table, moving only in a forward direction, disciplining yourself to ask one question, not 15, one, not three, one. And at the end of the question, you draw an imaginary question mark in silence on the table. Well, what miraculously happens is if you stop talking for 2 seconds while you draw that question mark, you might get the person to actually say something in return. You can't do that all the time in conversations. It looks very strange to be drawing question marks when you're speaking to people. So this is very much a practice drill, back to the golf metaphor or the golf analogy. But it's a drill that you can practice to build that comfort of asking questions and then being silent so people can actually share. Now, that doesn't address how well you listen once they're speaking and the quality of your listening. But, you know, at the risk of making this answer 15 minutes long, I'll stop there. Also, because I know how much great content you all already put out about that very idea of mindfulness and being present and things like that.
Sure, sure.
I love the application to silence and the value of silence. And really, you know, I think humble inquiry is right there as well. Really asking good questions, not just questions for the sake of questions. But a lot of times you hear people that can't stand any amount of silence. And so there's an effort just to fill the gaps.
Yes.
What are any other practices there that we should consider with just getting comfortable with silence and as part of conversation?
Sure. I'm going to jump to the practical quickly because what people have found quite helpful about the book, and we know this because they've communicated it back to us, is these incredibly practical things you can implement today. So that whole notion of comfort with silence, you have to remember that the thing that is probably causing you to want to fill that silence at every moment, that may be some sort of a psychological or emotional or a mental state, but it has hardened into a physical habit that probably affects the shallowness of your breath, that certainly affects if you do glottal stops or glottal attacks, which is basically closing your vocal cords to hold your breath, that probably impacts how frequently you shift your eye contact, that probably impacts a whole bunch of ways in which you're telegraphing physical and vocal impatience. So you have to address it physically. And I'll give you a couple different tools. One is that same chapter on structure, meaning you use a tool to force yourself to say one idea at a time and tolerate silence at the end of it long enough that you have to live through the silence. Another activity is a super simple one in which you practice, and you don't even have to tell colleagues that you're doing this. Just do it, okay? On video calls, put yourself on mute and only unmute yourself when you're going to speak. And you can tell the collected group, hey, I'm doing this, folks, because there's some kind of annoying background sound. I don't want to make you all have to listen to that. So I'll just unmute myself when I'm going to speak. But then put your keyboard very far away from you. I mean, like 4 feet across the desk. So that when you're going to make that motion to unmute yourself, just the distance that your hand has to travel elongates that silence a little bit. And then practice that every day. Now, don't do this on calls in which you know that it's going to be a heated conversation and you've got to fight to get your voice in there and, you know, they got to get a word in edgewise. That's a different situation. Give yourself a freebie. But in situations in which you can practice and maybe less from you is actually better in that situation, it's a very simple way to practice building some comfort with silence.
One of the things we do with medical education, we're training students to take histories as videotape the interaction and the communication. Is that part of your approach?
Yes. I'll give you that single word answer because I want to underline how important it is. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, guys, the old cliche, time flies when you're having fun, certainly holds true here. Michael, this has been a great conversation, and I know that we could continue it on and on, but we're going to wrap it up. And Michael, once again, thank you so much from Baptist for taking time out of your busy schedule to be on the podcast. I know it's going to be valuable to our listeners. The new book is Don't Say You can find it at Amazon or wherever you buy your books. You can also find great content at michaelhepner.com and also gktraining.com. So once again, Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for the good work you all do.